Session number 3901, reel number 2.
Alan Lawson, Reel 2. Why did you leave the Gaumont studio at Shepherd's Bush?
By this time, this was in August 1930, I'd had this rebuff about if I wasn't satisfied, get out. And I'd got to know the cameraman at Stoll's Studios and also the director of the film. Who made films at Stoll's, having worked for him at the Bush. I went and saw them, and they offered me a job, and they offered me £3 a week, which I decided I would accept. And I went back the next day and handed my notice in to the studio manager. And he said, "Oh, but we've given you a rise. You must reconsider your decision, you know. We've given you a rise, we're going to give you £2.05, which was quite unheard of. It was a rise of £1.05. However, you know, it still didn't match the £3, and I didn't really like the way that had been done, so I said, well, you know, I'm still going. And I left and started... I worked my notice out, and I started at Stoll's in August in 1930, and stayed there until March 1932, when there was a lull in production, and you know we were in fact not making films for ourselves, but making films for American companies to satisfy quota needs, and nobody knew how long we were going to be, as it were, on holiday, unpaid. And by this time, I'd made a relationship with an American cameraman. Over at Ealing, in that which in those days was called Associated Radio Productions. That was Bob Martin, cameraman there. So I went to see him, and again I was offered a job, but he was rather sorry he couldn't offer me, as it were, a proper job, as he called it. He could only offer me the job as a number boy for the time being, but with the proviso that if they ever should use a second camera, I would be the operator of the second camera. And I started there at £3.10, which the £3.10, I think I drew for 2 weeks after that. They always seem to be using the second camera, so my take-home pay used to be very much more than that every week after about the second week.
Did people always get jobs by word of mouth?
Yes, I think so. Yes, you know, you were passed on. You know, I was very lucky. I'd been. How I'd got to meet Bob Martin was, there was a man working with Associated Radio Productions, a chap called John Puddy Carstairs, who had worked at Stoll's, and they were doing some exteriors, or some, they were doing some back projection plates or something for some American film. And John Paddy Carstairs had rung up Stoll's to ask if they could provide a camera assistant for this American cameraman. And I was I was told to report. Report to meet him at Charing Cross, you know, to catch the train to go down to Tilbury. And I think it was 6 o'clock, I think, I had a meeting at Charing Cross and catch the train to Tilbury, and we were going aboard the Batavia line and coming up the river, filming back projection plates. I don't know what the film was for. I don't know what it was for. I'd ordered a taxi. I'd got up in good time, and I'd ordered the taxi, I think, for 5:15 or something like that. I'd got up in good time and had my breakfast. 5:15 came, 5:30 came. No taxi, so I got to Golders Green station, got the first train. I can remember this, arriving at Charing Cross. Of course, nobody there. I explained the predicament to the ticket inspector, and I can't remember quite what it was, but anyway, he suggested another way, and in fact, I got to Tilbury, but the wrong bit of Tilbury, and got a taxi, and got there more or less the same time that Bob Martin and John Petty Carstairs arrived. So they thought this absolutely, Bob Martin was very impressed and very kind and forgiving about it all, and I suppose I made an impression. So that's how I suppose it went by.
Did you ever see advertisements for jobs in the film industry?
No, never. Never. I suppose there were some. Well, in fact, I'm sure there were some, because I don't know when it was, but there was a studio called Sound City, which is Shepperton Studios, which was there were a lot of people working there who, in fact, had invested money in the company. I mean, they were amateurs. There was one, dear old George Stretton, who was in the Naval Film Unit, ultimately. He had invested money and become the cameraman. Glenn Denning was... I don't know if Glennie had invested money, but Glennie certainly was there at Sound City. But they may have advertised for for people to come, but they required money to invest in the company.
Were you at all affected by the Depression?
Yes, partly because, as I said, you see, at Stoll's, we were completely dependent on making quota films, which is pretty depressing way, really, because all the American companies were interested in was the right amount of footage to satisfy quota. I mean, that was it. They were satisfying quota. So, if you like, you could say it was more or less they were being fine, but they would be able to produce a film, a so-called film, for the money. It was pretty, pretty bad.
Did this affect the quality of the camera work?
Well, yes. But you see, I mean, you would. I mean, I can remember working on film, and we did 7 reels in 6 days. I mean, it was absolute slog, absolute slog. You did the best you could. And the quicker you work, the sooner you're out of work. And this is basically was one of the big points in the founding of the union. We were all getting a bit fed up with this. You were always told at the beginning of a film, well, we've only got X amount of money, and the harder you work, chaps, the better it will be. Of course, the harder you work, the sooner you were out of work.
At this stage, there was no union.
No, the union really didn't really. The union started to evolve round about 33, because this is when I got sorted out at Ealing. I'd fallen foul actually, because I'd not only had I organised our own, been instrumental in organising our own union.
You had gone to Ealing after Stoles.
Yes, after Stoles. I'd organised the union there. Not only had I done that, but the electrical trade union, who had no representation at all in Ealing, or any that they did have, the boys weren't revealing themselves, because the chief electrician had fallen foul of the union up at BIP at Elstree, in fact, I don't know the background of the trouble, but it was nefarious practices on somebody's part, and anyway, the union eventually refused to work with the chief electrician. And so he left BIP and he went to Ealing. And obviously he didn't want the ETU in there. But, you know, ultimately we persevered and we got the union in. But
what union was that?
ETU. That was for the electricians. The NATCI union was there. The NATCI organiser, together with myself, got the ETU organiser in, and within 6 months the electricians were organised into the ETU. But by then they'd sorted me out, and you know, they were waiting for me to fall on my face, and they put their foot out one day and I certainly fell on the face.
How did that happen?
I was very unlucky. I had a charge hand electrician who was working against me, and the second in command on the staff, who was a very loyal chap. He was one of the people who'd helped me organise the ET. Used to come and tell me that lights had been switched on. You know, after I'd set the lights for a scene, he'd come and say, well, he'd now switch some more lights on.
By this stage, you were a lighting cameraman.
Yes, I was a lighting cameraman by this time. And, you know, this was my first film. I was getting very upset and about all this. And eventually, there was a row, and the studio manager just told me that I was fired, and that was the end of that. And I then found it very difficult. I tried to try and get jobs, and I found it extremely difficult. And I suppose I was very fortunate, in as much as the head of the sound department at Ealing, when I first went there, was a man named Marcus Cooper. He'd had a row with Basil Dean, who was not the easiest of people to get on with. If you'd had a disagreement, Marcus Cooper left, and a Captain West came in and took over. West was a real boffin. He'd worked with Marconi and various other people in sound. And he didn't last very long, again, because of the disagreements with Basil Dean. He left. But, I knew him. I'd got to know him, and I'd got on quite well with him. And there was a sound recordist chap called Philip Doughty, whom I'd worked with on Three Men and a Boat, who was a very nice chap indeed. And I think he only came in for the one film. I think he decided he didn't really want to work at Ealing. He didn't like the setup. He'd been loaned to us, I think, from Shepherd's Bush. And I met him one day and, you know, he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, you know, you work with Basil Dean and you work down at Ealing. I'm out of work." And he advised me to go and see Captain West, who was then working for Baird Television as their head man. And I went and saw Captain West, who greeted me like a long-lost friend, and said yes, he had a job for me. They had an idea of an intermediate film process for television. The idea was to have a film camera on top of a processing machine, a rapid processing machine, and you would record the images on film and process them immediately. And that is how I started in television. And I remained there working on, you know, on this process with Captain West was head of the company, really. John Logie was not, really. He was he'd been shuffled off into a research lab of his own and, you know, given an allocation of money to really literally play with, because he was, you know, unfortunately, he was behind the times. Modern inventions had come along, superseding the mechanical devices that he was using, you know, mirror drums and discs and these kind of things. And we were working on this intermediate film process, which was installed into Alexandra Palace, along with the other Baird equipment, on an experimental basis, where we did transmissions for 1 week, EMI did transmissions, you know, we did alternate week transmissions for 6 months, and the BBC would, after the experience of the 6 months, take the best of the, you know, of the processes. Well, being out of work again, because Baird's obviously was not the best of the processes. I mean, we had this rather limiting device, this intermediate film process. Brilliant idea, but of course extremely inhibiting, because you were stuck. The only thing you could do was change your lenses. In those days, there wasn't a zoom lens that was adequate for what you want. And even then, it's still very inhibiting, because everything would be shot from one angle. But this is, in fact, what we were doing. We had a film camera on top of a little processing machine.
Were you called a cameraman?
Oh, yes. Because I was a lighting cameraman. Still, I lit the film and I operated the camera and I did everything on that.
How different was that to operating a camera in the studios you've been in before?
Well, as it was not a mobile camera, it was a very easy job to do. It was just a matter of very long takes. We ultimately finished up using split 35. It was 35mm film, but split down the middle, so it was 17.5. And you what was it, 20-minute takes, you see. That's what you were doing.
What were you filming?
Yes. And 30 seconds later it was transmitted, you see.
What subject were you filming?
For plays, anything. Anything they stuck in front of it, we filmed.
Did you go outside?
Oh, no. It was fixed. You were fixed to drains, and you'd got... we were using a high-speed developer. It was 5 seconds development, a wash. We were using cyanide to fix. So, you can't wheel cyanide around. So, you know, you had virtually an open drain to get rid of your stuff. And the you were working at a fairly high temperature too. I think we were working at 75 degrees, And so the emulsion was very sticky, got very sticky. The picture, the images were magnificent. The trouble was there was the sound. Because again, the soundtrack was between the edge of the film and the sprocket holes, and not between the sprocket hole and the picture. And so that's a very small area. And again, you were scanning underwater, so you were getting the sound gate was inclined to get bubbles, so for no reason at all, they'd suddenly, when somebody was talking, it would just like a whole series of raspberries, one after the other. No sound other than just raspberries. So it was rather disconcerting. So the BBC, in their wisdom, decided that really wasn't a very good idea and chose the EMI system. And so, as I say, so being out of work again... I then was invited to film the television demonstration, the first television demonstration film, which was made, for the, as it were, to show the trade in the mornings. They had to have something to sell television sets because there wasn't television in the mornings. I've forgotten what the times were, but I think there was 1 hour, I think, or might have been an hour and a half in the afternoon. And then kind of after you'd had your supper, after we'd had our supper, you would start the television system up again, for again 1.5 hours or 2 hours or whatever it was. It was a very gentlemanly way of doing it.
Did you have a set yourself?
No. Oh, no.
Did you know anyone who had a set?
No. I thought that people who bought television sets in those days were mad. I still inclined to think they're a bit mad, but still. But no. I mean, I was born and bred, as it were, in the cinema, and to me, there was only one form of entertainment. That was the cinema. And this other thing, this small little box, who was going to sit and watch that? Now look at us, with hindsight.
Can you describe the different characteristics of each of the studios that you had worked for before working on television?
I suppose Shepherd's Bush working at Shepherd's Bush, I suppose it was at a difficult time. There was this very strong personality, Maurice Holvey, who had really stamped his image on the Bush, and everything was rather correct. Not being addressed as Sir, but it was always Mr. Holvey. To the majority of the staff, the senior cameraman there, a chap called Percy Strong, was a bit of a stickler, although very fair, but a bit of a stickler. And there wasn't one didn't. I certainly didn't. Apart from Sid Bonnet, I had no real friendship at all. In the studios. At Stiles was an entirely different atmosphere. There was a cameraman who I'd got to know very slightly, Desmond Dickinson. There was another assistant there, a chap called Gibbs, and another assistant called Chown. And we were very close-knit. You became a very close-knit unit, and we worked very closely together. The sound department, again, there was a very friendly department, and again, we were very much involved as an entity. The chief electrician, again, was... You were part of very much a family there. And this was a very nice atmosphere, which soured a bit later, again, partly because of this making films for quota purposes, and you dealt with companies who hadn't really got sufficient money to make the films, and they were cutting all corners they could, and you were finding you were using all kinds of film stocks which no self-respecting cameraman would use. There was that kind of thing, but you know, that was because of the quota situation, really. And then at Ealing, for the first time, one started to use some of the best equipment. This was the Associated Radio Pictures, in fact, was an offshoot of RKO of America. So they'd sent equipment over. You know, you had American equipment, which was pretty good equipment, and you know, you suddenly found that you, and the kind of things that you dreamed about, here they were.
What were these cameras?
Mitchell cameras. I mean, they were very good cameras, and I think we had four of them, which is unheard of, you know, four Mitchell cameras.
What had you been using before?
At Stiles? We had one. Oh, I think we had two. And again, you usually found, you know, this was, at least this was my experience, you usually found American equipment, which you bought, was usually second-grade stuff. It was the throw-out. I can remember the gates in the Mitchell cameras at Stoles. They had to work on them to stop them scratching. The ones, of course, over at Ealing, they were perfect. Well, anyway, they were second. It was second-hand equipment from Hollywood, but it was very good equipment. The camera department again was run by this very nice American, Bob Martin, who was a very kind man, but very weak indeed. He wouldn't stand up for his unit against the bosses. One used to get imposed upon a tremendous amount. And also, again, one had, I suppose, like a lot of businesses, you come up against personalities, really. Basil Dean was one of them, who could be charming, absolutely charming, and he could be an absolute bastard. So of the three studios I worked in, I suppose that Stoles was the happiest. Any length of time, I suppose Stoles was probably the happiest.